And welcome back to Cinema Vino. Sean Jordan's here with me again.
Howdy.
And we're going to talk about, this is part four, and the last installment of our Oscar snubs. Again, to qualify, a movie has to literally be nominated for zero Oscars and be a really good movie.
Yeah, so. And this one, like I said in the last pod, this one has the record as being the highest rated movie on IMDb to not have a single nomination.
Yeah, it's crazy. One of the most influential movies ever made, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
One of the most iconic.
Yeah.
Watching this movie feels like you're watching a movie of cliches because of this movie.
It started them, yeah.
Yeah.
This was the one that kicked off. I mean, I think Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More kind of were the early, the rough drafts of the movie this would become. Not that those movies weren't great also, but this is like the Spaghetti Western masterpiece. This is like the Citizen Kane.
Yeah, and Clint Westerns. Eastwood actually has, between this and Dirty Harry, I think some of the most iconic movie bits from the 60s era.
Yes. Oh, he was, this movie launched him as a superstar. And throughout the late 60s and early 70s.
I guess Dirty Harry is the 70s.
Yeah. It's like he became like one of the most bankable box office stars in the world.
Because he's really good at squinting at stuff.
Squinting and saying very few words.
There's no dialogue in this movie for the first 10 minutes.
I love Tom Hanks like talking about Clint's directorial style, where it's like where they're filming a scene, and literally he does not say action or cut or any of that stuff. It's like literally he'll lean close to his actor or whatever, like while they're about to start shooting. He's like, okay, go ahead now.
And doesn't he only do one take?
I mean, very few. He's notorious for, like, being under budget and ahead of schedule. Like,
and, like, the actors are like, oh, no, I messed up. Can I do that again? He's just like, nope, we're rolling with it.
But, yeah, he's like, okay, you go ahead now. And then it's like when he's done, it's like he'll literally, he won't say cut. He's like, that's enough of that. And it's like, I don't know how any actor could turn around and be like, no, we need to do that again. Where it's like looking down, Clint Eastwood's like, oh, okay, well, that's enough of that.
Clint Eastwood squints.
Yeah. No, we're done here. Okay.
Oh, that's enough of that.
We don't need a second take. It's like, okay, well, then we don't.
All right, Dad.
Moving on, Dirty Harry.
He's going to yell at some chairs later.
As he does.
He tends to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which I've never done. That might be therapeutic. You never know. That might be a good way to blow off a little steam.
I don't think it's worked well.
No, it's a bad look.
No.
So we're going to continue also our series looking at wines that, varietals, grapes that haven't gotten a good rap either. And so we've done Merlot. We've done Chard. Last week we did Riesling. We're going to look at Red Zin this time. I think people think now of Red Zin as the big California fruit bombs. Over the top.
Well, Australian Zins are also big, too.
Yes. Right? Australian Zins can be very high in alcohol, almost to the point of being a fortified wine, like a port or a sherry. You look, I mean, at least they used to be. They could be 16%, 17%, big, like, alcohol, like, you can taste the heat.
Yeah.
Burns your taste buds. And so I think that Zinfandels, as a rule, from both places, got a bad rap. The one we're drinking right now is the Vine Star from Brock Cellars. It's a Sonoma Zin. And, I mean, right away, I'm looking at the bottle. It's 12.8% alcohol. So this is one of the lower alcohol Zins you can come across.
Yeah.
It does have that jamminess, but I think it's got some other textures to it, too.
It doesn't have the tackiness that leaves your mouth feeling like you just, like, sucked on some chalk.
Yeah.
You know? It's a good, good texture.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Definitely has some sweetness to it.
Mm-hmm. It does have that fruitiness, that dried fruit kind of currant flavor to it, I think. Mm-hmm. Or like that kind of blackberry jelly, a little bit.
Yeah.
It does have the classic California Zin.
A boysenberry.
Yeah, it does. But it also doesn't have that, it's not over the top, it doesn't beat you over the head. And you get a little bit of a spicy kind of peppery flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if I'm putting this particular wine with a food, I would say pizza. Do a good,
yeah,
get you like a good like slice of pizza,
like a good greasy pepperoni.
Yeah. Well, this would be perfect. I mean, again, for a movie night, get you pizza and a good wine. That's, you can do worse in life.
Ooh-wee.
So yeah, this is Vine Star from Brock Cellars. I'll post a link on the website, cinemavino.net. This will clock in around $20. Also, most of the wines that we feature on these podcasts are going to be about $20. I thought about doing,
not for any reason other than Todd's just cheap.
Yeah.
He doesn't give us the nice ones.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and every now and then we'll splurge for sure, but it's like, I mean, I feel like most people have that budget every day.
Yeah. When I'm looking at the wine, you know, store, I'm not looking for a $30, $40, $50 bottle.
Yeah.
Looking for a $20.
Yeah.
You know? Something like a $15 to $20 range.
Yeah. And plus, I think once you graduate from 20 to 30 to 40, there's diminishing returns. You don't get what you pay for.
Yeah. Unless it's a special occasion, like,
stay
around 20.
Yeah. And if you jump up to that next level, it's like, it really helps to know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And to know the what kind of grapes you're looking for, what kind of years. You know, there comes a point to where you need to really kind of do your homework if you're going to spend the money. Or know somebody who
Which
has.
Which I am not.
Yes. $20 is a good no-brainer area where you can find something good.
If there's a random tag on there that says it's like a 92 on some rating system I've never heard of from a magazine that probably doesn't actually exist, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the worst that can happen? You get drunk on wine?
Oh, no.
I thought about doing like a Italian or Spanish wine. Thought that might be a little bit too on the nose, for doing. I mean, there are some great Italian wines.
We featured a cava last month, I think.
Yes. And I think we did a Prosecco in there too, possibly.
Maybe. Yeah.
But also, it's like I couldn't really think of an Italian wine that's been snubbed that doesn't get its due. I mean, maybe Pinot Grigio. I mean, but also Spanish wines. Part of the beauty of Spanish wines is they fly under the radar. There's nothing that really, like, I would qualify as a snub, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Spanish wines are sort of doing their own thing while France kind of steals all the glory.
Yeah. The thing about, like, Merlot, Chard, and Zin is that they are big, famous, iconic wines that, you know, are kind of dismissed. They're kind of taken for granted. And people may not necessarily see what they're great for.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that's the case for Italian wines or Spanish wines necessarily.
No.
So.
Is there a varietal that you think is overrated that most people really gravitate toward, but they shouldn't?
Overrated? I mean, I'm thinking. It's like, I have never been a huge Cabernet guy. I mean, it's like the classic thing where it's like,
A Cabernet Sauvignon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's iconic for a reason. It's huge. I mean, but I don't love it, you know?
Sure.
I think that there's a lot of Cabernets that are one-dimensional, and they're dry, oaky, you know, smoky. Again, they don't have that well-rounded.
It has a good appeal for people that don't get really into wine.
Yeah.
And I think that's why cabs are really what I've gravitated toward, early on. But.
And that's not to say that there's cabs that I don't love.
Yeah.
But
I've definitely branched out past that.
Yeah. But it's like, I mean, for example, like thinking about a steak wine, it's like Cabernet is the classic steak wine. But I also think about, like, I love a good Merlot.
Yeah.
I love Merlot. A Cabernet Franc.
Mm.
You think about those, like, French wines. I mean, the French Cabernet Francs, like the Chinons or the Bordeaux, which are going to be Cab Merlot, Cab Franc blends. I mean, it's like, or even like a Malbec, straight Malbec would be a good steak wine. So it's like, I just think there's other options out there, you know? So I just don't naturally gravitate towards Cabernets, you know, like some people do. And you know, that may be, I know that there's a lot of wine snobs, a lot of really non people that love Cabernets. It's just not my thing, I guess, you know, but it's kind of like how we were saying, like, I didn't love the original West Side Story, the 1961. It's like, it's a classic, you know, it's in the Library of Congress. It just didn't quite do it for me, you know?
Interesting.
Everybody.
Second mention of Library of Congress tonight.
That's how you know we are nerdy, pinkies out tonight.
Yep.
Talking about the Library of Congress.
Well, the Yellow Sea, as all our friends at home call it.
But, I mean, that's like everybody has those classic movies that everybody loves that, you know.
The Criterion Collection of movies, yeah.
You have that unpopular take of, like, I didn't love this movie, you know, and that was definitely one for me.
Interesting.
There's a few of those classic movies where it's like, I just don't get it as much.
Yeah. Speaking of which, okay, so The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, 1966.
December 23rd, one day before my birthday.
Oh.
Yeah.
December 23rd is my parents' anniversary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they got married right before Christmas.
Yeah, they were musicians, so there wasn't a lot of time that they had off. Yeah. So Christmas was really the only time that they could do it.
No tours going on then.
Right, and they would highly recommend not getting married around Christmas.
Mm-mm.
They say it's pretty terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I would recommend not having a birthday around Christmas. Also, well, not the best.
You know, you don't get to choose that.
No. Although I petitioned my parents hard to move my birthday to June.
You should have pool parties out of protest for your birthday.
Oh, yeah, I'll do polar bear.
In December. Yeah.
Yeah, we're diving in.
I like that idea.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to do that next December.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the third film of Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy, after Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. Although some people have, I read threads where they call this a prequel. The movies are loosely connected in terms of plot. You know, it's like I have trouble connecting them as the same characters in all these movies.
Yeah.
But it is almost 3 hours long.
It is almost exactly 3 hours long.
Yeah.
This is a hefty movie.
When I bought this.
A long 3 hours.
Yes. When I bought this as a kid, it was the 2 VHS version of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It is the opposite of the movie that we reviewed last week, Zodiac, which was around 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yep. 2:38, I think.
Loaded with plot. Loaded with characters.
Yeah. It's a very dense 2 hours
and 3 hours. Lots of information. Almost
this is a lightweight 3 hours.
Yes. It is deliberately very Leone style, was to very much spread stuff out. Let scenes draw out. Like the first probably 10 minutes of this movie, there's very little dialogue.
Sometimes Leone's style kind of feels like that scene in Monty Python where the guy's running.
And over and over and over.
The two guards are just sort of like eating an apple, and he just keeps running, mm-hmm. and keeps running.
And there's like timpani drums in the background, yeah. like rolling. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, one of them gets run through with a sword.
Yeah. Yeah. This movie has a lot of like guys off in the distance walking through smoke, guys off in the distance riding a horse.
Clint Eastwood walking through the desert.
Literally watching the horse ride away the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see what was going to happen.
Or Eli Wallach running in circles in a cemetery for.
Oh my God. I was watching this movie and Jonah came down and she was just like, what is this cinematography? It's just like a blurry camera just spinning.
Mm hmm.
And I was like, this is good, Ben the Ugly.
And ironically, this is one of them, in terms of its cinematography, its look and feel, this is one of the most like influential Westerns.
Iconic.
Yeah.
The I think the most iconic scene, and you know, there's a ton in this movie, is the final showdown in the cemetery,
mm-hmm.
with like the eyes darting back and forth between the people.
Yeah.
You know, and the zoom in on the gun and the zoom in on the eyes and zoom in on the other eyes. And,
yeah. You could argue this is the definitive Clint Eastwood movie. You know, yeah. This is up there.
This and Dirty Harry, I think, are his two definitive movies.
I mean, maybe Outlaw Josie Wales. I mean, there's a couple other like Westerns that would be up on this level, but not many. You know, for a guy that's probably done, I mean, maybe triple digit Westerns, probably definitely easily double digits, 50 plus.
Yeah.
This is at the top of his list.
Yeah. This is, I would say, number one most iconic Western.
Yeah. And it's weird because this definitely was a hard pivot for the genre.
How so?
And it's interesting because go back and look at a movie called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which came out in 62, 4 years before this. It was directed by John Ford, who was the classic John Wayne director. And that movie starred John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. And it's generally considered to be like the last classic old school Western that came out. And it's very corny. I mean, it's very, like, Lee Marvin is Liberty Valance, the villain. It's very black hat, white hat, like, good and evil. I mean, you know, John Wayne's a classic, you know, howdy ma'am, like, you know, old school Western hero.
Good cowboy, bad cowboy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it definitely introduces a little more shade into the genre, a little more texture. It's also, like, an epic movie. But it definitely is a completely different feel from this movie. It is the classic black and white, more conservatively filmed, staticky Western. Big, grand score, Western score.
Yeah.
You know,
and this, I mean, Clint Eastwood is not necessarily a good guy.
Mm-mm.
I mean, he's called the good,
yeah,
the bad, and the ugly, but he's not necessarily good. He's kind of a crook.
Mm-hmm.
He's running with his friend Tuco, and
yeah,
they're running a con where he basically turns them in for money. And then shoots him down off the noose.
For all the nerds out there, he might be chaotic good at the best.
I would say he's possibly even a neutral.
Uh-huh.
A chaotic neutral.
Not neither good nor bad.
No.
Or
true neutral, perhaps.
Yeah. You go back and look at Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, I mean, and look at this one. And it's like you can see how much this movie is a departure from the classic. At this point, what was the template for American Westerns?
Well, and Westerns in this time period this is the tail end of that time period. That was the superhero movie of the day. You know, Westerns were the
John Wayne
genre du jour, where after that, gangster movies kind of came out, and gangster movies became you know, the next thing that everybody was making movies of. And I think a lot of the criticisms that superhero movies get nowadays is a lot of the same criticism that Westerns got back then and then mm-hmm. gangster movies got after that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and this, Liberty Valance starred like two of the biggest classic Western stars, Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne. And it's like, again, it's like even the look and feel, like I think about them, like you never saw them like dirty, grimy, sweaty. They're, you know, their outfits were always well put together. They were well put together.
No matter how dusty it is outside, they're just
clean shaven. Yeah. Their hair. I mean, everything was great. You look at this movie and all the characters, I mean, they're, you know,
dirty,
5 o'clock shadow, sweaty.
Yeah.
You know, grimy. The first shot that I can think of.
There's an excessive amount of sweat in this movie.
Yes. I mean, just, they look rough.
Yeah.
The first shot that I can think of the movie is like that big extreme close-up of the guy like going to the town, like that wrinkled, like grizzled face of that outlaw coming to kill, I think it's Eli Wallach. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, that extreme camera in his face. You didn't see that in older Westerns.
I'm thinking of the scene where Eli Wallach is getting beat up in the sergeant's cabin.
Yeah.
And it zooms in on the guy and he's just so sweaty, mm-hmm. like, dripping sweat. And he's just like, trying to like squeeze the eyes out of Eli Wallach.
Yeah. Crazy. And it's like, yeah, this would be a good companion to do those movies back to back. And you can see how much this movie changed Westerns.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, to do that more European aesthetic where it's like the lines between good, bad, and ugly are blurred. Mm-hmm. You know, they're murky. And to where you don't have those heroes anymore like you used to.
Yeah.
It kind of, it reflects not only that European mindset, but also the mindset of the 60s. You know, where it's like you had like the biggest box office star of the late 60s was Steve McQueen, you know, and he excelled at playing people like Clint Eastwood who were like kind of ambiguous. You know, you didn't know where they stood in terms of good and evil sometimes.
Yeah.
So it definitely reflected the times. It definitely changed like the way that we looked at this genre, maybe a little more accurate to the period, you know.
Yeah, it definitely felt like this movie was trying to portray the Civil War era a little bit more accurately, kind of display a lot of the violence in war.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of depictions of, you know, dismemberment and warfare and just general, you know, casualties.
Grimness.
Yeah. And I think that wasn't represented in any sort of Westerns prior to this movie.
One thing that's interesting about these spaghetti Westerns, they were one of the first movies to really break down the Hollywood production code. Before, in like classic Hollywood, you had a production code of like, between all the studios of stuff you could do and stuff you couldn't do. And one thing that you could not do before these movies came out, especially in Westerns, was you could not show somebody firing a gun and it hitting somebody and then falling down in the same shot. So in old Westerns, you would see the guy shoot the gun. It would cut to the guy wherever on top of the building or whatever. He'd, you know, throw his gun in the air and scream and fall over. In these movies, you would see Clint Eastwood draw and kill the guy in the same shot where he falls over.
Yeah.
That was revolutionary for this movie, and like it kind of started, that was the beginning of breaking down the old school production code. Another thing was that in the production code was good guys had to win in old school Hollywood. The bad guys could not win, and not only could the bad guys not win, but they had to be made an example out of.
Mm-hmm. I think that's Danny Trejo's personal motto, is he will always portray any bad guy as long as the bad guy dies.
Yeah. And that's the code. That's the way it used to be.
Yeah.
But then it's like you had movies like this where it's like you started seeing like the potential for bad guys winning. It showed like that shift in our view on things, our view on the world, you know. Mm-hmm. It got more shaded, got more gray.
Yeah, because at the end, spoilers, Tuco lives. Not that Tuco's bad. Tuco is an opportunist and he's somebody who will stab you in the back, you know, at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
But
he's a bandit and a killer.
Yeah, he's definitely not a good person, and this movie portrays his character very thoroughly.
Yeah. And so this was kind of that beginning. I mean, this movie, Bonnie and Clyde, the Warren Beatty, these are movies where you started to see the breakdown of the Hollywood system into what it is now, where you can kind of, there's blank check. You can show what you want in terms of violence, in terms of morals and ethics. You and it was around this time that the first like nude scenes started coming around. The first nudity, I believe, was a movie called The Pawnbroker, had the first like sex scene around this time. So you started to see those classic, like,
I think the only nudity we got out of this was Tuco taking a bath.
Not the most welcome nudity
in the world. Not pleasant.
If you want to see Eli Wallach naked, This is your movie.
You get it.
Quick rundown of the plot. I mean, and it's not much.
No.
Basically, Clint Eastwood, who's the man with no name.
Blondie.
Mm-hmm. Blondie. And Lee Van Cleef, who plays the bad and, you know, awful psychopath killer.
And Angel Eyes.
Angel Eyes. Eli Wallach is Tuco, also another bandit and killer, are all on the hunt for the same Confederate chest of gold treasure. So supposedly hundreds of thousands of dollars in Confederate gold.
$200,000 Confederate gold.
Yeah. And so they are in, I believe it's New Mexico.
New Mexico and Texas.
Yes. Which is interesting because it's like, it's great that they show, because I'm a big Civil War buff, huge Civil War fan.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a different podcast.
That's a whole different podcast.
Very different podcast.
I would love to do that sometime, but yeah. If this depicts like the New Mexico, Western Texas as like a major sort scene of combat, which it was not at the time. There's definitely battles fought there for sure.
Yeah, I thought that the Texas Civil War was mostly fought along the coast, kind of
around Houston, Galveston.
Yeah,
it was over the
hometown.
Yeah, for the basically the rights to the water. You know.
Yeah. Well, on Juneteenth was based on when news reached Galveston, which that was the last place to hear news that slaves were emancipated.
On the 14th of June. Yeah.
19th of June.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they depict lots of troops, lots of movements, lots of generals, lots of battles going on, which was not the case for West Texas, New Mexico.
No.
There were some small battles for sure.
And skirmishes perhaps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even where we are in Oklahoma, there are battles.
Mm-hmm.
My family has a farm, and so supposedly there was a...
Which we weren't a state at the time.
No, we were Indian Territory. There was a skirmish out there, and I was always finding like... I found, like, one point out there on the land, like, a coffee pot, an old wheelbarrow stuff buried out there.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. All along there where there's supposedly this skirmish took place, arrowheads everywhere. There's all kinds of stuff laying around out there.
Hmm.
You know, because that farm land has never been, like, settled by humans. So,
yeah.
You know, there have never been houses there or developments. So it's like, I'm finding stuff. It's like, I just wonder if that's from then. But the Civil War was everywhere in the country. It was fought all over the country.
Yeah.
In small amounts. The main battles, like you said, were like around the Mississippi and in Virginia.
There was a lot of state militias.
Yeah.
You know, getting into
skirmishes. It actually went all the way to northern France. There were battles of the Civil War fought around Cherbourg.
Oh, yeah. Which wineries were involved?
And that's a whole different podcast, but supposedly one of the ships was sunk with treasure that they found later.
Treasure?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
One of the Confederate ships.
Confederate gold!
The blockade runners, yeah. It was filled with Confederate gold, yeah.
Why did they have so much Confederate gold? What were they doing with it? They weren't paying soldiers.
No, they were not. There were a couple of things. It's like they didn't have an agreed-upon paper currency in the mm-hmm. Confederacy. They never really nailed that down.
Should have had Bitcoin.
Exactly. And I think that when they run the blockade, they could use gold to help pay off their contacts in Europe for goods.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, but to the movie, basically,
we're talking about a movie, aren't we?
We got off on history for a second, which, you know, I'm sure is fascinating.
They're digging up Confederate gold.
Yes. And, basically it's like, if you know that part of the plot, that's all you need is it's three guys looking for treasure. But
getting into various hijinks along the way.
Yes.
Lots of hijinks involved.
Double crossing each other, plotting, you know.
A lot of imitating various soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Wearing uniforms. Yeah.
You know, this is very heavily steeped in Civil War. Like they're crossing
mm-hmm.
lines, crossing, you know, back and forth, imitating soldiers, wearing different coats.
And for these guys, it was like they didn't care about North and South. They were just opportunists. Yeah. You know, they'd put on whatever uniform was around.
Yeah.
If it helped them cash in.
Whatever helps them not get, you know, strung up.
Yes, exactly. This has probably the most iconic Western. I say probably. It is the most iconic score.
Yes, this is the most iconic score.
Ennio Morricone.
Hands down.
If you go on Spotify it or YouTube it right now, you'll know it instantly, even if you haven't seen the movie. To me, that's the definition. If I have to put one together for the word iconic, is like even if you haven't seen the movie, you know what it is.
Yeah, the references have outgrown the movie itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's like if you see like Judy Garland singing Over the Rainbow with Toto, you know, if you haven't seen the movie, you know what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's that big. You know, it's that famous. And that this is definitely, this movie is that famous.
Yeah.
To where you know the music if you've never seen it.
Which, so interestingly enough, do you know what beat this movie for, or won Best Picture this year?
I want to say it was A Man for All Seasons. I could be wrong, but I believe 1966. Mm-hmm. We might look this up, but I believe it was called Man for All Seasons.
No, I think it was Sound of Music.
That was 65, which would be interesting too if it was competing with.
Huh, okay.
But I think it was 60, this is going to be dorky. 65 was, I believe, Sound of Music.
Sure.
66 was Man for All Seasons. 67, I think, might have been Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
It gets weird because the movie, when you try to look up like 1966 Oscars, it's like, is that the year that the Oscars were done, or is it the year for which the movies were being awarded?
Yeah.
So you always kind of have to look a year in advance.
The 2021 Oscars are being handed out in a couple of weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's the 2022 Oscars.
Yes.
Yes.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
But I think Man for All Seasons, which is a good movie, but again, it's like we go back to our Oscar podcast where it's like, raise your hand if you've ever seen it.
Exactly.
I've seen it, but I'm a giant dork.
Yeah.
You know? But, I mean, it's like people have seen Good, Bad, and the Ugly plenty of times.
Well, and people just know it. It's stood the test of time to where, you know, people know the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly references way more than they know the movie.
Yeah. Now, like you say, it's outgrown itself in terms of its...
To the point that when you go back and you watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it feels like a parody.
Yeah. It started those cliches.
Yeah.
It's like watching The Godfather, you know? It's like, this almost feels like a parody of itself because it's like so many people imitated it. So many people have spoofed it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's outgrown itself in pop culture place. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
Or seeing like The Beatles in A Hard Day's Night or Elvis Presley. It's like, this almost seems like too big for itself. You know, it's like this is... pop culture lore.
Yeah, when Elvis has been impersonated so much, seeing a movie about Elvis, it's like, okay, I get it. It's one more person doing an Elvis impersonation. You know?
Yes. Which I will say, there are some Elvis movies where he's doing a bad Elvis impersonation.
Well, and there's an Elvis movie coming out this year, I think.
Yes. And I forget who Baz Luhrmann's doing.
Baz Luhrmann?
Baz Luhrmann.
What an unfortunate name.
He did Moulin Rouge. He did... the Romeo and Juliet with Leo and Claire Danes. Hmm. So he's Australian, and he did the Australia movie with Hugh Jackman, Nicole Kidman. I don't know if you saw that, but that was unfortunate.
Sounds unfortunate.
Yeah. But it looks like, based on the trailer, that movie is an Elvis Presley biopic, but it's from the point of view of Colonel Parker, his manager, who, again, Hungarian, German, something. Played by Tom Hanks.
Yes.
So, looks interesting. That's an angle that I've never seen the story from. Hmm. Just because Colonel Parker has that reputation of being a huckster who, like, basically swindled Presley out of a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, he was that classic guy who took him for a ride, as people did back then. We're getting off the subject. We'll get back. The second podcast tonight, we've always had a lot of wine at this point. So, you know, it tends to veer a little bit.
We're veering.
Yeah.
Tell me more about the Civil War.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Who was fighting in that? What were they fighting about?
Mm-hmm. So another thing you could do is go back and watch Kill Bill and see the influence that this movie had on Tarantino.
Yeah.
Huge influence. Go back and watch anything, Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he would admit that if he were
sitting Hateful there. Eight, for sure.
Yeah.
I think Hateful Eight was... Tarantino finally getting to do a Western, to a true Western style. And I loved that movie. I thought it was great.
Even Django had some spaghetti Western vibes to it.
Definitely did.
But I even thought Inglourious Basterds had some spaghetti Western vibes to it.
Yep.
Even Scorsese. I think if you go back and watch the classic, like, high-octane, violent Scorsese movies, they definitely have that Sergio Leone feel to them. Yep. So, very influential movie.
Did this kind of bring an end to the Western? Or were there a lot of Westerns that kind of came after this?
The Western, I mean, there were more spaghetti Westerns because he did Once Upon a Time in the West. Some people say that's his best spaghetti Western, the best spaghetti Western. That's debatable. I think you could watch the two and compare them. There's not a wrong answer there.
So let's talk about spaghetti Westerns in general, though. Mm-hmm. So spaghetti Westerns are Western movies that were shot generally in Italy.
Or Spain. Yeah.
Or Spain.
Or Europe.
But it's called spaghetti Westerns because it was shot there.
Yeah.
Why? Why did they shoot there? Was it cheaper?
I would imagine that it was probably for them as European filmmakers. They could probably get better breaks, mm-hmm. cast actors they knew. And
well, and so I know one of the things is the Sergio Leone only spoke Spanish.
He was Italian.
He only spoke Italian. And then, Tuco, the actor who played Tuco, only spoke Spanish. And I think they communicated by speaking French.
Yeah.
Because they didn't speak the same language.
I could see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you can kind of see a lot of the language. The audio is kind of weird in this movie.
Dubbing is weird.
A lot of dubbing, because its original audio is Italian, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, or it's Italians trying to speak English.
Yeah.
So that makes for awkward dubbing.
So a lot of stuff is dubbed over, and there's like awkward audio. But, you know, you get used, if you can get past that, it works.
Yeah. But they tend to be lower budget.
Yes.
You know, more shoestring. But also, filming in Europe, you're not bound by the Hollywood standards. You can kind of be more adventurous. Which is why at that point French movies were so huge. The French New Wave was big because they were kind of going against the Hollywood norms in terms of storytelling.
Norms.
But also in terms of like their visual style, you had a lot more close-ups, a lot more jump cuts, a lot more like more arty camera work that you see in these movies. These movies definitely look and feel European and how they're done.
Big wide shots.
It's a European riff on a Western.
Yeah.
I put it like that. But then, yeah, you didn't see a whole lot of Westerns made after this, after these spaghetti Westerns. They would pop up every now and then, but a lot of them, it almost felt like a goodbye to the genre. Like John Wayne's The Shootist that he did in 76. He was, and I think Jimmy Stewart's in that one too. He was already very sick by that point. And so it was almost like a goodbye for not only him, but for the genre. Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. Also felt like an ending to the genre. Like it's almost like a benediction to Westerns. So,
well, and I think since then the Westerns that have come out have been really good. Mm-hmm. You don't see the cheap Westerns coming out. I mean, you still see some, like they remade, Magnificent Seven,
mm-hmm.
With like Chris Pratt.
I think.
But like
Denzel Washington,
which is another, Sergio Leone movie, right?
That was George Stevens, and that was, it has Eli Wallach in it for sure.
Oh, that's what it was. It was Eli Wallach.
And Charles Bronson is in that.
I was just cruising through a bunch of different IMDb pages.
And that was based on The Seven Samurai.
Yes.
The Akira Kurosawa. Magnificent Seven it fits kind of the mold of classic Western, but that's also kind of like one of those proto Westerns that kind of starts, mm-hmm. you have like all these bad guys brought together to do good, you know?
But I think the Westerns that we've seen come out since then, and especially the ones that, I mean, go back and listen to our Tombstone episode. I think we go really in depth with Tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tombstone's a great Western.
Mm-hmm.
I think 3:10 to Yuma is a good Western,
mm-hmm.
Which I think that one's another remake, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That one's Christian Bale and, I'm blanking,
Russell Crowe.
It's a remake of one with Glenn Ford from the '50s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Classic. I almost call it a potboiler Western where it's like, you know, just that classic, like it's just making money, you know, it's not going to like redefine the genre, but it's a good storytelling Western. Open Range with Kevin Costner was another really good Western. That underrated, I think, that came out in like 2003, early 2000s.
Cowboys versus Aliens.
Yeah, Wild Wild West.
Yes, Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
That is the iconic Western that we all need to hold up.
Mechanical Spiders in the third act.
Musical numbers.
Yeah. You could do Unforgiven as a pair with this, too. I mean, do it like a beginning and end for Clint Eastwood in terms of Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
Because that feels like Clint Eastwood's last great Western. I went back, and that's one of the first movies I reviewed for my review site was Unforgiven, just because I wanted to go back and watch it. And it holds up really, really well. It won Best Picture. I mean, that's definitely the opposite of a snub. It won Best Picture. Gene Hackman won Best Supporting Actor. It was nominated for everything. It's a great Western to watch. You know, it definitely, that's the ultimate, like, dark, grim look at what it's like, the downside to being a gunfighter. In a way, it's almost like The Irishman with Scorsese, where it's like the people who have lived long enough, you know, the killers and mobsters who've lived long enough to have to think about what they've done.
Yeah.
That's Clint Eastwood in this movie. It's like he's weighed down by the fact that he's now 60 years old and he's done horrible things. So
that's kind of the way that Tombstone is, too.
Yeah.
Is you kind of get to see Wyatt Earp, you know.
After. Yeah.
You know, after his career as a gunslinger, and kind of seeing him, mm-hmm. you know, reconciling with that part of his life and trying to grow out of it.
Yeah. And, I mean, literally trying to run from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely there have been some great Westerns made since this and since this time period. But like you said, the gangster movies, film noir, other stuff took over.
The age of spaghetti Westerns kind of ended with this.
Yes. Once Upon a Time in the West was made after this. I think it was 68. There's a movie that came out a little bit after this called Fistful of Dynamite that Sergio Leone did.
Badass name.
Yeah. It's called Fistful of Dynamite. I believe it was James Coburn and... I'm trying to think of who else was in that. I've seen that. It's been years and years. That was a pretty good little Western for the money. But after that, you didn't see a whole lot of stuff come out. It really kind of petered out as a genre.
I would say it peaked. I'd say it peaked.
Right about now.
And the ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, well, and it's just, you know, I think with the 60s, 66 was kind of like the middle part of the early phase of the counterculture movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally. Think with that, you see a big swing away from Westerns because Westerns are very much like, you know, your dad's movie.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's like, think about 1966 and then go back and watch The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance or go back and watch like some of those old like Rio Bravo, John Wayne movies and think about how old and outdated those must have seemed by 66.
Yeah.
They already were like past their time.
I mean, can you imagine watching this movie on LSD?
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. What would you give it? Scale of 1 to 10?
I would give it probably a 7. Yeah. There's some really awkward parts just in the way it's filmed. There's some parts that are kind of clunky. And like you said, it's a very long movie.
Yeah.
And when a long movie feels long, it's not a great sign.
Yeah.
But it's very much 3 hours long.
Yeah.
It feels 3 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just because there are those long shots and there's not a lot of content mm-hmm. to keep you like, okay, get to the next scene. I want to see what's going to happen with this. It's not a complex story.
Very spare.
Very spare.
Yeah.
But it's good.
Yeah. I think in the wine world, you would say the word austere to describe
austere.
Very lean meat. It's lean meat on a big plate.
Yeah, I'd say that's accurate.
But at the same time, it's like, from my perspective, because I love this movie, and for me, it's a 10. And I would say, and again, I could totally see that side of it too, though. 100% of like being frustrated with it.
It's also hard to watch this movie with fresh eyes because it is so iconic. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, the score is obviously, you know, amazing.
But
ubiquitous. It's permeated the zeitgeist. I mean, is the iconic sound of a Western.
Like a showdown. Yeah. Yeah. Gunfight.
Yeah.
You know, but also it's like, it's kind of like when we were watching Godzilla versus Kong or whatever. And I was telling Travis like that, you know, I got kind of bored with the dialogue. It was lousy. You know, the characters were thin. And, you know, his argument was that's how it's supposed to be. That's how these movies are.
Yeah, I want to see the monkey punch the lizard.
And it's like, that's kind of the same thing with these spaghetti Westerns, where it's like they are deliberately very lean, very... I heard a critic use the word languid. It's like they move like molasses on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the style of it, you know, where it's like... And Leone was very much a stylistic director. It was about the look. You know, it's about Clint Eastwood, you know, a long shot of him puffing a cigarette, staring people down.
God, he smokes so much in this movie.
Yeah.
So much.
Oh, there's a scene where he lights a cigar with another cigar. That's how you know it's like, this is real. Yeah. Yeah. He's chain smoking. Yeah.
Also, how badass is it? I mean, how many matches does he have on him? And are they all strike anywhere matches? Because he flicks those things with his thumb to light them.
Yeah.
That's badass.
Yeah.
That's iconic.
Yeah. I think it was the previous, for a few dollars more, there's an actor named Klaus Kinski, and I believe it's Clint Eastwood who strikes a match on his face.
That's awesome. You know, I think he does that to Tuco in this movie.
He at least flicks him with one, like flicks him with a lit match.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and that's one of the things that's like, in terms of the pacing, the story, it's like, you're either in on that or you're not. And I totally get not being, or being having to be in the right mood, having to be in the right like frame of mind for it.
I can't imagine watching a 3-hour movie in 1966.
Yeah.
I feel like movies back then were like an hour and a half movie was a long movie.
Mm-hmm. But it was a mix because you definitely had, I mean, that was also the heyday of like Sound of Music, you know, My Fair Lady. It was Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, Patton. You had these movies that were huge. I mean, there was a genre of epics. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like epic filmmaking. Bridge on the River Kwai.
Those movies also had intermissions back in the day. They would intermission during the mm-hmm. theater, and you can go out and take a little
intermissions,
break.
Yeah.
We should bring that back. Honestly, we need a pee break.
At 150 minutes, I believe. You know, that was the Alfred Hitchcock thing. Was like a movie should never be longer than the capacity of the human bladder.
Yes.
That was his rule. And he never made a movie that long. There are no three-hour Hitchcock movies. And so if a movie's longer than 150 minutes, I think a bathroom break is
absolutely warranted.
Yeah. Take a break. Come back. I mean, literally do it like the theater where you do like the chimes or whatever at certain intervals where it's like, boom, boom, boom. You can go take a bathroom with that because it's like you think about it, even something like the Batman, you know,
you had to gird yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. You saw me. I had a large drink. I had a large Sprite.
You sure did.
And that was a challenge to make it through 176 minutes of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, but at the same time, it's like, I want a Sprite, you know?
It's fair.
I mean, look
at the size of my water bottle. I drink a lot of water.
Yeah.
When I'm not, you know, in a theater.
Man needs a motherfucking Nalgene.
Yes.
I'm just saying.
This is a Hydro Flask, but I won't take it personally.
It's like, you know, you shouldn't have to, like, not get something to, you know, concession because you think, well, this movie's so long.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have a break. That should be a huge thing. It's like, okay, 75 minutes, everybody get up, stretch, come back, use the bathroom, get yourself some Raisinets, and get back in here.
Yeah, I could see myself sitting through a three-hour movie in 1966 if I had an intermission.
Cinema Vino is brought to you by Raisinets.
Eat Raisinets when you go to the movies. Raisinets.
Yeah, I've said it before. I want us to get sponsored by a cigarette company. 4 out of 5 doctors recommend the cool flavor of Camels.
Oh, God. I think that's a good point, though, is that this movie kind of did set the tone for little cigars, like cheap cigars.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
I think they became really in vogue
because
of this movie.
Clint Eastwood's look, I mean, the poncho, everything, mm-hmm. that was iconic. That made an unfortunate comeback about 15 years ago with women wearing ponchos.
We should bring ponchos.
And so there, I would see, like, shoppers in the wine store wearing ponchos. It's like, what are you doing? You are not the man with no name. You know, if you come in there flicking your cigarette or your cigar or whatever and, like, you know, buying Italian wine, I'll give you credit for that. But no.
Yeah.
You're not a badass.
Can you imagine if someone walked in rocking the full-on man with no name vibe?
I always think about Groundhog Day where there's one of his, like, runs through the day. He is with a date going to see Heidi Part 2, and he's dressed as a man with no name. And, you know, she keeps talking to him, calling him Phil. He's like, no, I told you, call me Bronco. And, yeah, that's definitely the good, bad, and the ugly.
Shout out to Bronco Henry.
Yeah, exactly. Wherever he is.
There you go. That's another good Western that came out.
Exactly.
Power of the Dog.
Uh-huh. And it definitely fits that darker, revisionist. I mean, it's a character study for a Western.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, so is Unforgiven.
Yeah.
You know, it's a meditation on, you know, what that's like to be that guy. You know, larger than life,
mm-hmm.
which I still think that's going to win. I think that's the best picture winner.
Power of the Dog?
I believe so, yeah. My favorite of the year.
We will find out.
Yeah. My favorite is Drive My Car. I love Licorice Pizza, but I do. Power of the Dog comes in at number 4 on my own personal list, I believe, but I think it's going to win.
We all know that the number 1 on my list is Dune. Dune is at the top and should win everything.
Yeah, but I think Dune 2 has a strong chance, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the Academy doesn't like awarding partial movies.
No.
So Dune Part 2 will sweep. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. You'll never see them award a movie, like you said, when they know another one's coming out.
Yeah.
So they're gonna hold out judgment.
Lazy.
Yeah. But also not a bad thing. You know, it's like, you know, because it's like, I mean, think about it. I mean, what if you were going to give an Oscar, in theory, to The Matrix, and then Matrix 2 comes out in 3?
They should. Matrix 1 was a great standalone movie. Matrix 2 and 3 kind of took away from the first one.
Yes, they ruined it.
I mean, they yes-anded themselves in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But again, whole other podcast.
Whole other podcast. One that we got way too drunk for.
But this has been another episode of Cinema Vino. Vine Star by Brock Sellers is going to be our wine for this week. It's a Sonoma Zen. $20. It's a nice, well-rented Zin. It is perfect for this movie. It's perfect for the previous movie you did, The Zodiac.
Very palatable.
Yeah. It's a good, fruity, accessible red wine.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good one to do for just about any movie if you like red wine. If you do like the white wines, the Ravines that we did, the Dry Riesling is excellent. Mm-hmm. So, but Sean Jordan, thank you so much.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And next up, we're doing baseball movies. That's going to be a whole other ball of wax.
There's no crying in baseball.
We're going to do some great baseball movies. So it's going to be one for the books. It's going to be a lot of fun. So we will see you guys next time.
Later. Be sure to listen, rate, and subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our website is at cinemavino.net, and reviews of these movies can be found at toddwoffordmovies.com.